Hi, this is Jose Antonio Coelho, Sr., and you're listening to the great Walt Weekly Podcast.
Good evening, and welcome to the Walt Weekly Podcast. My name is Walter Latham. I'm your host. I'm here with Michelle Sweeney McCombs, your co-host. And thank you for supporting us, and hopefully y'all guys had a great week since last Friday, because we are here every Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Today's topic is one of those broad ones. We're going to talk about the construction industry in New York City. And you know, our guest that we have on tonight, this guy is going to be able to provide you with answers to questions that you might not necessarily know or you want to know. And if you, especially if you're thinking about going into construction. So we have the right man. That's been in it for years. He knows it inside and out. And, you know, we want to welcome him. Michelle's going to do the introduction. But let's get down into it, into the construction industry in New York City. We're talking billions of dollars, folks. Billions of dollars. A lot of paper. Okay, with that said, Michelle?
Hey, thank you, Walter. And welcome, everyone, to the Walt Weekly Friday Live. Thank you to our live audience for joining us. We appreciate you. Please follow, like, and share the Walt Weekly by clicking on the bottom right button, share button, to share virtually. Thank you. The Walt Weekly is brought to you by Michelle Sweeney Hair and Skincare. Our intro and outro music is provided by Uncle Nephew. Today's panel members, we have, as always, returning Christopher Sweeney, out of New Jersey, retired New York sanitation worker and CEO of Johnny Roof's Catering Smokehouse. Next up, our next panel member out of the Bronx, New York, Honorable Gene Edwards, male district leader, 79th district. So we have an amazing guest today. We thank him. Today's guest, he's originally out of East Flatbush, Brooklyn, Joseph Anthony Coelho. He's an activist, educator, and a businessman. Thank you, Tony, for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into the questions?
Yes, peace and blessings. Thank you for having me today. My name is Jose Antonio Coelho, born New York City, 61, to Afro-Cuban parents. Grew up in Brooklyn, surrounded by family and friends, you know, who endure to this day. Continued on public school throughout New York, City College, Brooklyn Tech High School. Married my childhood sweetheart, Sonia Rebecca, had our first child in 1981, a young man, extremely mature at 19 back in the early 80s, late 70s, and spent about 22 years in the pharmaceutical industry before moving on to sort of like an entrepreneurial spirit here in New York. So that's kind of, that kind of rounds me out, unless you want more. I got more, but...
Yeah, I got one question for you. I just got one question for you before we start with the questioning. Would you consider yourself an expert on construction?
Yeah, I do, because the only way you get to be an expert, I think, in anything is if you have failed. You have to have failed in any of your endeavors for the most part in order for you to see the full scope of the nature of that industry. Construction in New York City has a history, some good, some bad, but fortunately things are looking up now. But a lot of work has been done. A lot of folks have been injured through the process. A lot of families have been devastated through the construction process. But we live to see another day, and here we are to speak about it.
Yeah, the reason I ask you that is that for those weren't on officially until 6. But, you know, the construction industry contributes about $800 billion to our economy. And it employs about 7.8 million people. Right. So it's a big industry. And there's a lot of money out there. So the reason I asked Jose is that, you know, I wanted to know from your point of view, starting in construction,
right,
did you have any hands-on jobs within the industry prior to your rise up into the executive area or, you know, the managerial oversight board position.
Right, right. So I had a very unique entrance into the construction industry. First off, my stepdad and my biological father both worked for themselves. And so I had this sort of spirit of working in terms of business, in terms of carpentry. They were both excellent at that. And my unique entrance into construction was that I was brought in as a member of the community benefit agreement for Barclay Center back in 1999, 2000. And I recognized an opportunity to bring young men into the building of the Barclay Center and the housing that's attached to it. But once I got to the table, I realized that getting individual jobs was not going to be enough. I needed an opportunity and a vehicle to enter into construction, and instead of hiring one or two, get a contract and hire 20, 25, 30. And so I was uniquely positioned on the board of the Barclay Center community benefit agreement, but I also then went out and found a buddy of mine and my older son, and we bought a company called Brookman Construction. And Brookman basically did all of the legwork to become a certified entity in construction. And we were doing rebar. Rebar is the metal poles that you normally don't see in concrete, but it's in every sidewalk, all the foundations in buildings. It's an unknown job because you don't see it because of the concrete. But we entered into that industry of concrete and rebar. And we were training folks on how to do rebar, brought a guy in that understood rebar well. And we started training young men. And so that was a great opportunity until you get to the point where the unions step in. New York City unions are notorious. And where the commitment to getting your invoices paid back to you in time and your insurance requirements and your bonding requirements, these were all of the things that would set back most African-American and Latino contractors in New York City. And to this day, it still does. But we have put a couple of opportunities in there for them to move forward. So that was my entry into construction back in 1999-2000. I went on to do work at Barclay. I did the Van Wyck Expressway, which is still going on today, I-287, a couple of waste station management stations. And we did fairly good. We did pretty good for a young upstart that didn't know anything about construction to begin with. So that was my entry in, very unique there.
All right. When you mentioned Barclays and the Van Wyck, that you did those. Now, were you in the planning stages? Did you do the initiation and the end point?
So normally when we, and I say we as in African-American and Latino contractors, we enter in after all of the pie has been divided and we catch those crumbs off the table. And I just say that to say, normally the developers develop, the engineers come in and engineer, they look at the mechanical, the electrical, and the plumbing. And once they split off all the pieces and the architect has designed all of these areas, then they go out to bid. And that's when we catch it. We catch it as a bid package. And we look at the bid package. We spend about $2,500, if not more, to coordinate and estimate a bid package. And then you create your document and you send your bid in. And you send your bid to the developer or to the owner, and they lay all the bids out on a table and they start to go through them one by one. They call that leveling. And once they level off, they pick and choose, which is a random. Sometimes can be extremely random. And it could be the friend of the family. You never know how they picked or why they picked. And so that's how you get your first toe into the pond of construction. Once you win a bid, now you have to provide documentation. You have to provide the insurances. You have to supply your bonding. You have to make sure that you have the manpower. You have to have your supplies, and you have to have these things prior to starting, before you get your first check. So that means you have to have money in the bank. And without that money in the bank, you're barking up a bad tree, because sometimes it can take from 45, 60, 90 days, sometimes 120 days to get paid. And you've got to carry all of that until payday. And so it's not an easy road.
So you have to fund that up front.
Yes. Right. Yes. You have to fund it up front. And then if you're a non-union business, and that's why non-union has, it has its place in construction. But if you're a union, then you have to worry about not just the wages, but there's benefits that are applied to this. So health benefits are applied to your union workers. So where you might have a non-union worker that gets paid $40 an hour, or $30 an hour, the union worker gets paid $60 an hour and another $40 in benefits. So that's the benefit of being in a union. But unfortunately, by the numbers, African-Americans and Latinos do not share in the opportunities as union members as others.
Why is that, though?
Well, I mean, it's historical. New York has a very long history with unions, from dock workers, team workers, all of the industries, whether it be concrete. Unfortunately, it hasn't been a history that has done New York well. There have been local elected officials. There's been laws that have been put in. There's minority set-asides that have been done, which don't always pan out well for us. Once you get a minority set-aside, you're looked at as a set-aside rather than being right in pocket with everyone else. So the unions they mastered all of what was going on in New York through the years. And sometimes it took legal opportunities to remove them. Sometimes it was jail time. Sometimes it was, different things. But we've moved beyond most of it, but a lot of it still exists. A lot of it still exists.
Okay. Because I had a specific question, and I was going to say, let me preface it with, maybe I've looked at too much TV, with The Godfather and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I heard that nothing gets done on a construction site without the approval of organized crime. All right. So I'm looking at too much TV, or you don't get to that granular level where you have that. You got to be impacted one way or the other, since it's post.
Yeah. Organized crime can mean many things. Organized crime, as you well know, crime is not only syndicated crime. It could be within the companies. It could be within the political system. It could be within the agency system. That corruption comes at many levels, and we've seen it all in New York. And there have been many opportunities to eviscerate it through the years. Some have been successful. Some have not. But not all goes through organized crime. But it does go through a process. You hear? It does go through a process.
Right.
And sometimes that process is strictly relationships. And when anything is strictly relationships, you could leave it up to the imagination where it can go from there.
Right, right. I got you. I hear that. So, but let's move on. I do have a question regarding the infrastructure bill that was passed. It was signed. I don't know when New York. I know New York is going to get a good chunk of those billions, for infrastructure. I know y'all guys got to be busy, preparing proposals. Do you have inroads into, the political authorities that oversee or will be overseeing these projects? Are y'all guys starting to ramp up?
So I've moved to the left of construction, the ideal construction of building. I'm right now in the building management systems right now. That's what my new company, JC Energy, is doing. We're a New York MBE firm that provides comprehensive building management systems, all for capital improvements in the energy sector. Right. And, we deal with community education, job opportunities, and NWBE growth. But what we specifically handle are all aspects of inside the building now. Mechanical, electrical, plumbing, fire safety, and security. And so, the infrastructure bill, we've been on that for the past 2 years. As you know, any bill in America doesn't get passed unless it's been sitting around for 2 to 4 years, if not more. So we've had to figure out who the political folks were. We've been to meetings with some of our local elected officials, our Brooklyn delegation from Congress, Hakeem Jeffries and the Honorable Yvette Clark were on top of that infrastructure bill. We've dealt with them discussing how the rollout was going to be. The rollout is going to be having to do with a lot of bridges, streets, capacity building in terms of wireless energy, in terms of Wi-Fi. I mean, it is unbelievable how many young people struggle just to get Wi-Fi, although they might have a computer. A lot of our NYCHA tenants don't have Wi-Fi. It's something that we're looking into doing now and making sure that the powers to be make sure that that's an appropriate and a very priority situation. We've talked to the mayor, the new incoming mayor, about this. And so we think we're on the cutting edge for the first time of this amount of dollars and cents that are going to be rolling into New York. The infrastructure bill, we're looking forward to it. Now, in terms of construction, our folks have been on the ground sort of gathering. COVID has really, it's really taken a toll on everyone. And I'm praying that everyone's family has been held over through this time. Right. But COVID has positioned construction a lot differently because, folks couldn't get outside. Folks could not begin the jobs that they had in the middle of. Some buildings were on the fifth floor. Some buildings were just, the roof had to be put on. Some buildings were in the basement. So it took a while to ramp back up in construction after some of the COVID mandates were lifted and after some of the precautionary issues were done. So the construction industry is not at full tilt yet. They're still catching up to that 2-year hiatus in terms of COVID. So that's going to be the dilemma moving forward. How do we ramp up to get to that infrastructure money?
Okay. All right. I'm going to let it go over to the panel. I do have more questions, but I know I want to hear from the panel. Chris?
Hey, good afternoon, folks. What's up, Joe?
I'm great, man. How are you, Chris?
I'm good. I want to take it back a little bit if I can. I know Where you are right now is in construction, but you started out in the pharmaceutical industry and you pivoted and you got into activism. How did that activism play in where you are right now? Because I know growing up, I know you, I looked up to you. I hung out, I was along with your brother. We hung out around the way and we saw you and you guys were, you led the way for us. So just give the audience a brief synopsis of where you came from in that arena.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Chris. Yeah. You've been a brother and family member to me as well through the years. I spent 22 years in corporate America with one company, which is unheard of these days, a company by the name of Sterling Drug, Sanofi Pharma. And Sanofi was actually one of the companies that was talked about throughout this COVID process. But I held a couple of multi-level managerial and executive positions. I came in I came in working in the mailroom, as most jobs used to be back in the 70s and 80s. And, they saw something there. They saw a spark there. And I was just inquisitive about, customer relations and marketing and promotion. And I just kept getting promoted throughout the company until I gained very extensive knowledge in sales and marketing, warehousing, new product launches. And I stayed there until 1999. And the reason why was because at that point, after 20 some odd years, my kids were getting older. I wanted a sort of change in life. The money was good, but I was not fulfilled internally. And I think a lot of us get to that point in our lives where you're just not fulfilled. There's something that you want to do that makes a difference in other people's lives. And me working 9 to 5 in the pharmaceutical industry for people that I didn't know who was even taking the drugs and the pharmacy stuff, it just wasn't there for me. And so I launched into a career into community organizing with at-risk youth. I worked for Dr. Susan S. McKinney School downtown Brooklyn in Fort Greene, Fort Greene. And I met a gentleman by the name, and my mentors, I've had some of the greatest mentors that ever lived. And hopefully at the end of this, I'm going to shout all of them out. But I worked for a gentleman by the name of Dr. Walter Beach. And Dr. Walter Beach was the New York City recreational chief of recreations. but he was also a cornerback for the Cleveland Browns, who Jim Brown was the star. And so Jim Brown has an organization called the AmeriCan program. And back in 2000, Jim Brown came to Brooklyn and he sat with myself and Dr. Beach and a few other of us youngsters. And he said, we need to go into these schools that are laden with at-risk youth, gang situations, family turmoil. And we started this program at Dr. Susan S. McKinney. And I'm a national facilitator right now of AmeriCan. And we got engaged with the Board of Education. We had a contract with New York City's Board of Ed to help guide these youth and promote social skills, job training, community service for all these young folks. And then I took a position as a dean of that school in Fort Greene, and then I became the assistant director of the Beacon program. So I started really enveloping myself around young people and families. Just to take one step back, I come out of a very large family. My dad has 12 children, and we have lots of family and cousins. You know, your cousins back in those days were almost like your brothers and your sisters. And so I was happy to get back into the arena of serving young people, serving families, and so on. So that's where I was. And that's when I was approached by Professor Roger Green, who was the assembly member for that district in downtown Brooklyn, along with Major Owens and John Flatow. And they asked me to come and do some teaching at Medgar Evers. I did some training there for young people in community-based organizations. And so that's where that whole love of teaching and training started to come from. But, you know, that develops within your household. I had great mom and dad and cousins and aunts. And, man, their education was key. I don't care what you wanted to do in the street, but if you came out of East Flatbush, you had better known a few things. You couldn't be fooling around. So that's kind of was my background in getting into the nonprofit world. I'm also now the chairman of an organization called New Leadership on Urban Solutions that handles formerly incarcerated and at-risk youth. And I've been the chair for them for the last 12 years, along with the great late Eddie Ellis and Dr. Divine Pryor.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, Jane?
Yeah, I have two questions, actually. First, were you part of that group of brothers back in the 90s that would roll up on construction sites? Sometimes y'all have baseball bats, and you would demand those white contractors to hire Black and Latino. And my second question is, I've seen an overwhelming majority of, you know, of men from South America that are taking up these construction jobs or any type of skilled trade. And I know they're not in the union. They're not getting paid union wages, but they're eating up the work. So I would like you to speak. To both questions, please.
Sure. So I don't want to commit, you know, incriminate myself here. But yeah, I was part of that crew. There were many crews. It wasn't just, and it didn't just start with the young men of my age. This was something that we learned how to do by the late, great Sonny Carson and Abubakar and a lot of brother Ateem Ferguson from downtown Brooklyn. I mean, we learned how we were called coalitions at the time. That's what the wording is. Coalitions was the name of the group. And what we called the activity was shaping. And we used to shape the neighborhood and bring young men. We used to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning, get a school bus or a van and put 10 to 15 young brothers on the van with a nice construction hat and some boots and make sure they had a hammer in their hand. And we would drive around to all construction sites. And when I say we, you know, it wasn't, you know, we all came out of that. But that was what was necessary in order to put your foot down in your own community. They could be building right across the street from your house and be nobody there working that looked like you. And so we would say, we will not let a truck come in here. We will not allow you to bring supplies in here until you put one of these guys on. And they would do it. They would take them on. But not everybody felt that way. And sometimes it got uncomfortable. They changed some of the laws around that. So as brothers were doing that, you were getting some bids for that. And some brothers did time for doing that. And so we had to figure out other ways. And the language that I learned back then was we had to get out the streets and get into the suites. And so we learned how to do that. We learned how to incorporate our own companies. But you're absolutely right. This issue of shaping and the coalition work was something that was necessary. But I will tell you, it wasn't just the brothers in the street either. I was on the Brooklyn Bridge at one point with the great Dr. Reverend Herbert over at the House of the Lord. Herbert Daughtry. who led a coalition of us across the bridge and stopped trucks from coming over. So it was a combined effort from the elders, the young men, the politicians that were down with it, the black electeds who were really looking for ways to get through and punch through this stalled opportunity of construction. So that's the answer to your first question. And because I'm part Latino as well, I want to speak for my Latino brothers. You know, they come here with a skill set and ready to work. It's not their fault that they're being promoted out front. Sometimes you see them on the street and they're flagging and they're down in the hole. But believe me, they are probably only 30% of who's really making the money on a job site. A lot of our brothers have not learned the skilled trades because of the unions. You can't get into the union, so you can't learn the skilled trade. And for you to get into a school to learn the trade, that costs money. Where do you get that from if you're coming out of a poor environment, a poor young brother out of East New York or Brownsville or East Flatbush? So it's really about organizing. And so we've gotten our organizations together. The group that I was with downtown was a group called Rebuild. And that was the name of it. And we did the best we could with that. But again, we had to come out of the streets and get into the suites. This is where I am now. And where a lot of those brothers from back then have learned how to move forward.
Okay.
Joe.
Yes.
I was going to say, can you speak to the Brooklyn Armory and yes. Major Owens?
Sure. So I am presently the chair of the Major R. Owens Health and Wellness Community Center at the old Armory, the Bedford Armory, on Bedford Avenue and President, between President and Union. Back in that time when I was saying that I was doing guest lecturing at Medgar Evers, I met Major Owens. And what an excellent, great, 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 great individual. Very soft-spoken. He was a librarian by trade, but he was a congressman for 24 years coming out of Brooklyn, a Brooklyn congressman. And once he retired, Major Owens went on to work for the Du Bois Bunch Center at Medgar Evers College and under the tutelage of Professor Green and Professor John Flateau and Dr. Devine. And when they asked me to come in, again, I was so inquisitive as a young man. I'd love to sit at the feet of the elders and hear what they had to say. And Major Owens took me across to the armory one day. This was back, I think, somewhere around 2003, 2004. And he said, man, I want you to come look at this space, man. Look at this space. We should be controlling this space. This place has been closed for 30 to 40, 50 years. We can't have this, Joe. We got to do something. And that put the initial bug in my ear about the Major Owens, his ideas and what he wanted. He actually wanted Medgar Evers to take over that space because if you know about Medgar Evers, they've never really had a gymnasium or their own pool. They have a pool now, but they've never had a physical facility for recreation for Medgar Evers. And that's been a shame all these years. So he was hoping that Medgar Evers would take over the space, but that was not to be. And so back in 2015 or 2014, Mayor de Blasio had picked a team which included BFC Partners with Don Capocia. And the idea was, if you fix up this armory, we'll allow you to take some of the space at the end of that block and put two towers up, two residential towers. So the governor put about $100 million into that space for the center to be built. The center is beautiful. If you've never been there, please go to that center, 1561 Bedford Avenue, lifestyle, a pool, Olympic-sized pool, basketball, running court, soccer field, about 10 to 12 nonprofits, African-American and Latino nonprofits that are there, Itafeo, Digital Girl. There's a lot going on at the Armory. And so the Armory is built now. It's a great, great space for Crown Heights, and folks should really visit there. It's a wonderful space when you see it. And the residential is being built now. They're about halfway through one tower, and the other tower is just starting off. But when you go to the corner of over there on President Street, you'll see the two towers on the side of the Armory. And all the Armories should look like this. The Armory at Sumner, the Armory, there's several Armories throughout New York City, not just Brooklyn. Brooklyn's got about five or six, but the Bronx has about three or four, Manhattan, but they should all benefit the immediate community that they are in. And so this one God bless him, Major Owens. This is for him.
Okay. All right, before I before we proceed, there were a couple of people that tried to dial in. All right, we have call-in functionality, but we're not using it yet because we have nowhere to vet that call. Prior to bringing them online. So if you could just use the chat box to ask your questions or make your comments, and then we can relay them on to Jose. Okay, sorry about that.
Right. So I want y'all guys to know. Did you see Fax? Was there someone named Fax?
No, I didn't see him.
Oh, okay, that's probably Reggie, if he does do that.
Yeah.
Let's keep it in the chat. Put in the chat room, please.
And and then we'll pose those questions to Jose. Okay. All right. Great. All right, Jose. I have a few more questions. You are chairman of Minority, and my notes got a little mixed up here.
Yes, NYSEM, New York State Association of Minority Contractors.
Yes. Yes. That's what it is. I got about five screens in front of me here, so I'm bouncing between them.
Yeah.
Are you still active? Are you still in that role?
I'm still in that role. We're not active at the moment. COVID sort of slowed us down. We were actually in the Navy Yard for 30 years. This is an organization that has been well-oiled for a long time. I joined as a member about 18 years ago, and about 6 years ago, I took over the leadership of them. We were a chapter of the National Association of Minority Contractors, but we got a little bit too big, and we decided to just branch out on our own. And we had up to about 165 Latino and Black African-American contractors. We helped them out with their OSHA training. We helped them with their backroom operation. We helped them figure out ways to get requirements in terms of insurance and bonding. We did training sessions with them. We helped them estimate. We had a nice office in the Navy Yard. And we'll be back, but we wanted to redevelop the mission because the old mission that we had was that we would bring in members. We would be a membership organization. And we would have agencies sort of support us, but that wouldn't get us close to the contracts. That would just mean we were very good at what we were doing, but that didn't put money in anyone's pockets. So we wanted to change that the paradigm shift on the relationship, and we want to get closer to the developer so that we can put our young contractors in the hands of the developers as they're developing these projects and these young contractors to walk through the door and get a contract ASAP rather than sort of bidding on the outside and losing. Because again, construction is really about relationships that you build, and the agency like NYSEM, which has always been great and always been there, we just have to redevelop our design. And that's what we're in the midst of doing now.
Okay, great. Because I did have some questions around bidding. Sure. And I know you spoke a lot about bidding. But I want to drill down to some questions. As let's say I'm going to go, and I want to bid for cleaning services, after work cleaning services. All right, could you just walk me through from A to Z what I will have to be able to propose and what my bid should be? You know, when I say should be, I'm looking at all these other bidders out there, people that have done work prior to. That have a track record, and I don't. So could you just walk me through that?
Right. So let me step back 1 second. So when I took over NYSEM, one of the things I had to really get involved in is that we had a number of contractors that really and truly, by name alone, they were contractors, but they didn't have a company name. They were not incorporated. They didn't have a bank account that was set up to take money in and to give money out. They were not doing taxes the right way. They were not doing the things that were necessary, but they were bidding. They were trying to bid on jobs. And that really wasn't the right way to go. So I'm assuming you're saying if you've done all of the prerequisites and now you have all of those things to walk you through the bidding process, so here
yes.
we go.
Yes.
Right. So you get a bid either by mail or word of mouth, or you're on these agency, NYCHA, EDC or whatever, and you see something that fits your profile. You said cleaning. I've had a cleaning company in the past, ProTech Cleaning. I used to do cleaning for commercial construction sites. Actually, one of my first companies. And the first thing I'm going to look at is how big is this contract? Because I know as big as a contract is, I'm going to have a certain percentage of that in my bank so that I could pay again for the 30, 60 days that I'm not going to get paid until I put an invoice in. So I might need to get or be very realistic about a contract that's around $400,000 versus a contract that's $1.5 million. I've got to be very realistic about that.
Right.
Do I have the backing to do that? So let's say I take a $250,000 contract to clean up a space, a building that New York City owns, and I put the bid in and I win the bid. A lot of the bids that are won because they're low bid, not because you're the best person. They don't know if you're the best person, but they want a low bid. And the reason why them taking a low bid is okay is because you're going to sign your life away when you sign this contract that they could care less. If you lose money on this job, you're going to get them to where the job description is going to take you, whether you lose money or make it. That's why you have to be very careful. So they take the lowest bid. A lot of times people low bid and low bid themselves out of a job because you're not making any money. Some people want to just keep working, whether I make a profit or not. That's not the idea of business. Business is to make a profit. But some people just work to be working, to have money coming in. So let's say you get through that process and you win the bid. And now all of a sudden, now you have to go back to your team. Now you have to make sure you have the right manpower. If you're cleaning, like you using utensils or using power machines, or you're using supplies as in liquid detergents and those sort of things, gloves, mops, masks, foot footings, all those things have to be accounted for. And you should have those things in your close proximity and part of your business acumen. And so once you begin the process, let's say the job, they give you a schedule. Normally they'll say this job has to be done in 3 months. So now you have your backroom operation that says, okay, in the first week we're going to prep. In the second week we're going to begin. We're going to do a lot of demolition. We're going to do a lot of carrying out material. All of these things have to be on a schedule. And you have to have your early morning conversations with your workers. You have to feed back to the agency that, that you got the contract from in order to say, I am on schedule or do I need help? And so that's sort of how it happens. And after 30 days, 60 days, you hand in your first invoice. They pay you your money. You pay your workers. You pay all your bills. And then you continue the process until you get to the end. The beauty is once you've satisfied this and you've mastered this, now you can take on 3 or 4 jobs at a time, and you get the opportunity of doing 3 or 4 at a time, and now they start to pay for themselves. Now the money is coming in from different directions, and now you're not on struggle street like you were initially. So the initial stages of starting out in construction, or any business to me, is that first few months of struggle street, and you got to keep your eye on the ball. You have to have a backroom operation. Mom in the back handling the books. My little sister making the calls, that's not going to work anymore. It does not work anymore, and we have to move off of that.
Okay. I got 2 questions for you. All right. One is that 30 to 90 day or 30 to 60 day period that you have to wait before you see any money. So you're basically funding that. Is there a milestone or a deliverable attached to that 30 or 60 day? Or is it just, okay, what do you have to show them?
Thanks for asking that, because by the time you sign that contract, you would have created a schedule that they've agreed to. So if you said to them, the first stage is I'm going to be 30% done. And they'll say, okay, at your 30% mark, you can put in your first invoice. Now, if you've only completed 25%, you're in trouble. And if you can't get to that 30%, you're not going to get paid. And so those milestones are kept. And so once you hit your 30%, it still takes time. I'm saying that 30, 60, 90 days is after you've submitted the invoice. That's when that 30, 60, 90 days steps in. So you're really, really way out there. You really have to have funding in place before going into any of these endeavors. But yeah, there's a milestone and there's a schedule that the two entities have agreed on, you as a contractor and the individual you've contracted.
All right, good, good. We do have a guest, and you know him, Reggie Sweeney.
Yeah.
That's in the house. All right. I'm going to put him on if he's ready. If Reggie has his mic and he wants to come on, I can bring you in. I want to continue with this question. I want to walk through this process here. registered bidding, and you won the bid, and you get your you meet that 30 or 60 day requirement, and you get your first payment. Now, it the next payment, is it at the end of the project, or that varies the project to project? You may have like 3 deliverables before your end point, before
right,
you finish.
Right. So there's what they call retainage. Retainage is usually 5, 10, 15% of a project. So for every bill you put in and every invoice that gets cut back to you, they take out 5% of that to put to the side. So that money starts to build up a little bit. That retainage is kept to the end of the job. So let's pull that out. Let's pull 15% out from the money you're owed on this contract, long term. So once you keep hitting your milestones, you will continue to get process payments, progress payments, they call them. And as you slowly reach, and you're having meetings with the developer, or you're having meetings with the agencies to make sure that you're hitting the milestones, because it's not only you. If you're putting a building in, you've got electricians, you've got painters, you've got mechanical people. So if you're not on schedule, you're going to slow them down. That's going to eat away at your money. And so you have to be real particular and have someone really handling, project managing these jobs for you. You just can't be a lone soldier and a lone wolf in this world of construction.
Okay, great. All right, now I got Reggie. All right, Reggie's in the house. Reg, how you doing?
Do I just start talking?
I'm just saying you're here.
Oh, okay.
You're the man.
Hey, what's up, everyone? And listen, we're going to have a great New Year's and all that good stuff. Joe, what's good, Mr. Cross?
My brother Reggie, we go back a long way. My brother, how are you? I'm doing well.
You're lucky I didn't know that you knew my brother the way you did.
We're family, man. We're family.
It's all good. Yes. I've been listening. I've been taking the rail, trying to get in a spot that I can speak. A couple of questions that was drawn to you, especially the one about the new workforce that's taking over every single construction job, even the unions, I want to ask you a couple of things. Basically, how do you see the future of construction when it comes down to Black and Latino brothers, and especially this new skyscraper that I'm hearing that's going up in the Hudson Yard area, where it's a $1 billion skyscraper, all minority engineers, electrician, you name it. It's supposed to be built.
Yeah.
So you got any feedback?
Yeah, thanks for that, Reggie. And I appreciate it. Great hearing from you. I got one word for this, man. And Reg, we've been out here a long time. You and I have been on the streets. We started out in the streets doing what we needed to do, and we figured out some things. But this is about organizing, man. We don't organize. We got to organize, because I'm going to tell you right now, the future of Latino and Black construction work is going to be started at the high school level.
Yep.
It's got to be started at the high school level. And for many reasons, it's important, because a lot of the elders are aging out of construction. A lot of the buildings are falling apart. They're going to be revamping buildings and retrofitting. These young people got to get involved. I'm right now doing a program at Boys and Girls High School, CTE, with a brother by the name of Hudson. He's doing an excellent job, man. I went in there for the first time, and I seen 25 young brothers doing electrical work. And I said, wow, but why isn't that all over Brooklyn? Why aren't some of our agencies doing that? Why aren't we doing that at the church? Why aren't we not doing this in order to get our young people an opportunity? It's not all about 4 years in college and a master's degree. We know that now. This is 2021. We know that that's not the only way for us to make it. I used to employ union workers that didn't have more than a sixth grade education. And they were making $120,000 a year. They were feeding their families. They were great homes, great benefits, medical benefits. Their kids were going to great colleges. You don't have to have the four-year degree in college or a master's degree. But you do have to start somewhere. And I think that's the direction we have to start going in. Now, in discussion, that piece that you're talking about in Manhattan, right across from the Jacob Javits Center, there's a few groups that are, it's an RFP process from the state. EDC put that out. And there are a few groups that are bidding on that. I sat with one of the bidders, Mr. Don Peebles, the other day, and I had a group of about 15 contractors in a room on a Zoom call. That's organization. We got to organize. And I said, Don, we'll back you. We will back you. But we need to know that if you do happen to get this project, will we be at the table? Not behind the table, at the table. And when we got his assurances, I wrote a letter on my company letterhead to the new governor, Kathy Hochul. And I said, Kathy, we would appreciate if you put this process through and gave this win to Don Peoples. And their RFP is called the Affirmation Towers. When I tell you the size of that project is incredible.
$1.5 billion.
It's incredible. Right. It's 1,663 feet tower, two hotels, observation deck, 30,000 construction jobs over a 6-year period, 15,000 permanent jobs. The city and state would benefit $5.25 billion of new taxes on that. So, well, organizing, that's the key.
Let me offer you some too, you know, because I was waiting to really, you know, we can help some people. So now what I've been noticing, you know, with the bail reform and all of that, I am quite sure they're not going to be able to use tools in a prison, but we can definitely start, because I had a prison program. I hired a lot of guys. I'm the first African American in the history of the state of New York to go union as a painting contractor.
Yes.
We took some hell. You know, it's rewarding. I mean, I don't have the money that I should have, but it'll all come. But the goal for me was to just to build lives. When you have a letterhead, you can give sponsorship. You can offer something. And I think coming out, these young brothers got to have a mandate to coming out of there with some OSHA knowledge. You don't need a hammer. You don't need anything to bring them out. That's going to push our workforce to what it is. And then the other goal, you know, I just finished a 12-week course with Gil Baines. That's a new mentorship program that Gil Baines had. It's almost a typical one that all of them do to cover and make their goals. But I wanted to know, where is the plateau going forward? Because we vote these elected officials in. You know, you knew them, you and I, we fought for that bill. And I wanted to ask you, how do you feel where the application was like a binder and now it's just a small book? You know, these contractors that are coming out there, they got a real nice cakewalk. Bach Capital's out there. There's a lot of funding out there. There's a lot of things. And secession of Black-owned and Latino businesses. A lot of guys, you know, if the children don't want to take it over, so you have these companies just going, you know, they get old, they made their money, they want to move on, but they want to hand it over to somebody. And then, you know, one of the things that hurted us a lot, you know, me and you was up in Albany fighting, you know, they'll go after a guy like you. I didn't know you had all these connections because I took the Major Owens political course. That's what made me get into it, Owens, and I won his award. That he inducted me into the Congressional Hall, Congress. So the goal going forward, and I see the Latinos, they're being exploited. They're not working, but they stick together. So, you know, give me just three questions in one. One, how do you feel how easy it is for them to become certified and actually get the work and get the money? Because you talked about the AIA form as far as payment, and that was a good way of putting it. You have to have a line of credit. You have to get paid on time. And you know, they have a cakewalk right now. Then we struggle with our young people getting them into the flow. But it all goes back to the awards of contracts. You know, we can go up to Albany, we can lobby. I think the next governor is going to be Tom Suozzi, to be between me and, you know, that's my opinion.
Okay.
You know, and but I just think that we fought for the bill. They flipped the bill around. You know, we have white females in construction knowing long or well, they're not MWBs, their husband are behind the thing. And the unions play rough with us. I think it's an overall disrespect to the race. You can't win an election, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, without the Black vote. So we got to find a way to close this wealth gap. It's 100,000 to one. That's our problem. And then you have an influx of immigration. Then you have people that are here that can't get a job for whatever reason. You didn't want to let the Haitians in. We need a workforce. The United States is suffering with labor issues. You know, you see China. So 88.9% of the construction workers are white, let alone the contractors.
Yeah, Rich.
So these are our struggles and obstacles, but they are, you know, you got McKissick. We got to hire each other. We got to make sure that if we're doing the work and we are qualified, I won every bid on merit. I didn't get anything handed to me. And I think that now I'm not jealous. I'm a little annoyed that, wow, you mean to tell me Bob Capital's giving out $500,000? and you don't even, and you only in business in 3 years, where me and you've been in business, we couldn't even get a loan. So, you know, hopefully you can answer that and give me your take on who is actually the players now. Because I've been out, I took a break for a minute. You know, I had a son, so you know, I'm trying to get back in.
Oh, great.
Congratulations.
But I'm done. Thank you, guys.
No, great. Listen, that history that you put out just now is a culmination of the work that we've put in for 20, 30 years and that others have done in Brooklyn and New York City over the past 50 years. You know, politics is local. They say that, but that's real. Yeah. You cannot think about what the president is going to do when you don't even know who your own district leader is or your council member is. Yeah. You have to fight at the local level. You have to find out. And we have to get away from, I'm going to vote for them because they are black, or I'm going to vote for them because I know their mom. You really have to understand the issues that are going. If COVID didn't teach you anything else, if it didn't teach you anything else, we are at a survival mode. We are not in this thing. This is our whole health system, the inequities that were shown, the disparities. You have to go and now make sure that you understand politics to the nth level. You have to sit down. I used to sit down with contractors, and I used to bring them into the elected's office. They were scared to go sit with an elected official. Why? Because they didn't understand what that meant. They were afraid. Why? Because they don't have public policies in school. You don't sit and talk about what your city councilman needs. What are they supposed to do? We don't get that education anymore. I remember coming up, sitting in a room. They used to call it the Underground Railroad. Yep. Great name for us, where we might have Una Clark, Al Van, Major Owens, G2A Uci, Joe Mazariki. These are mentors of mine. And we would sit down and I would listen to them speak. And I know one thing. They left that room understanding the assignment. They left that room understanding what they had to do to get to the next level. These were guys that controlled that group that was called the East, downtown Brooklyn. They were part of the coalition groups. They were part of the clergy. We have to organize because, like you said, the Latinos organize because they got other things against them. They got other things going against them. So they have to organize and they do it well. And so we have to do some of the same things. Now, on top of that, we have to get our young people into the trades. I mean, we have to teach them electrical work. We have to teach them plumbing. These are $100,000 a year jobs. Why have we not continued that? If you recall back in the 70s when I was a young man, you used to be able to take automotive. You could take electrical. There were many things. And all of a sudden, these things were cut out. Who did it hurt? It didn't hurt anyone else but the African-American and the Latino brother. Because all the other folks, they were able to live under daddy's roof and get paid with daddy's company or daddy's friend had a job. And I'm not knocking that. All I'm saying was the disparity is real. And we have to understand that. But we got to organize. Without organization, there will be no future here. You see downtown, you see the gentrification. If you go downtown now, when I was a kid, the biggest building downtown was the Williamsburg Williamsburg Bank building. Now you don't even see that no more. Downtown looks like Disney World. Mm-hmm. If I had to calculate how much of that money we made on construction down there, probably 15%, 20%, if that. I'm being you know, gracious. And so that's been a major. Yeah, go ahead, Reg.
I'm sorry. My last, you know, what I got last thing. How do you see, because I was listening, going in and out on the train, you are still involved with NYSEM, the New York State Association for Minority Contractors. You still there over there at the NABR?
We're still available. We're still out here, but we have basically pulled back in order to redevelop and redefine our mission. So we haven't been together in about a year.
Okay. Because another thing, as you mentioned, as far as how we pick our policies, we wrote a white paper, you know, the concerning contractor, me, Jeffrey Smalls, Parkman, Plumbing. You remember, we went up, we lobbied.
I remember. Yeah.
And you know, like they had me kick the door in, you know, they all walked in.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think policy and educating the elected officials that I got to give Stephanie Zimmerman, a current state legislator, a lot of credit.
There was a bill
that was coming across her desk on the OSHA and everything, the mandate and all that. And she sent me the bill. I read the bill that night. It must have been 1 o'clock in the morning because she was nervous and she didn't just want to vote a bill because she was following, go along to get along kind of thing. And I read the bill and I said, Stephanie, you know, this is a good bill. You know, I mean, We are in a pandemic. It's a worldwide pandemic. I think you'll be okay if you put your name on this bill, if you're a co-sponsor. And why I say that is because if they reach out to us instead of reaching out to the people that don't look like us and get our hardcore perspective and really understand, because a lot of them don't understand what it's like to run a business, to have a program. I mean, Channel 7 interviewed our company because we were hiring a lot of guys that was coming home from prison, changing their lives and all that. And I felt honored that she even called me because I'm not the most favorite guy like them Bed-Stuy. You know, we can't even get work at Interfaith and we fought for the hospital. But I think as we educate them more and put a price to the vote, things will change, and it has to change because they can eradicate us totally out of construction. And one last thing, the project labor agreement, maybe you want to touch on that for companies that are listening and people that may want to get involved with this business, because what they did is they separated the owners from their shop. You know what I mean? And that legislation should have been critiqued a little more. You know, we were up there in Albany going at it, you know. So what do you see the politics and the type of candidates that are running for the seat that couldn't really care less about the African-American white? And you have a mayor now, campaigned on 3 or 4 different things, and one was closing that wealth gap. What do you think on that?
Right.
Appreciate everybody.
Yeah, thank you, Reggie.
Thank you, guys.
The one thing that I've noticed that has been very, very, I don't even know what the best word is here, but I've been feeling very aggravated at the fact that our latest group of local leaders, it's almost as if they just woke up in the middle of the night and said, I want to run for public office. They really don't have public policy interests. They don't have any of the historical knowledge. You have to have historical knowledge of neighborhoods and some of the fights that we've had along the way. You got to know the Shirley Chisholm fights. You got to know the Major Owen. What are you fighting for if you don't know the history? So a lot of these new young people are coming up. And with that, we're challenged. Do we vote them in and say, okay, I'd like to help you? No, I think the direction we have to go in is we have to come up with a black mandate. We have to come up with a paper. We have to come up with something that says, I'm handing it to all 7 of you. I'm not voting for anybody. All 7 of you, this is what I'm handing you. This is what we want, and we need you to speak to this. And then we will vote for who then we want to vote for. We have to move in that direction. We can no longer just vote our color or our, you know, we got to vote by knowledge and by experience and historical content. And so that's where I think some changes have to be made, how we vote new leadership in. Now, we've had some great leaders along the way. A lot of times they were stymied. We have never had a African-American a speaker of the House and City Council, although we've tried to do it 3 or 4 times. But, you know, we've got to move towards that sort of thing. We've got to move towards representation of people that understand politics.
All right, let me pivot over to our political person on the panel. Gene?
Yeah, I totally agree with what the brother said. You know, there was a time where when one would run for public office, they either were the chief of staff or some type of staff member or an intern, or at the very least had a degree in political science.
Right.
Nowadays, somebody just wakes up, stands on a platitude, and they feel like, you know what? I want to represent my community. I'm fierce, I'm bold, I'm audacious. And if they talk a good game and raise a lot of money within their community, they can confuse the vote. So now you have somebody who's incompetent in office. There's been a lot of that lately. And don't discredit the Democratic Socialists of America. Those are those followers of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They've been going around New York State and knocking off some incumbents that have done fantastic jobs.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about white incumbents. I'm talking about black and Latinos. They've been knocking them off and putting in people that work in nursing or, let's say, construction, that have no ties to politics. They don't have a pedigree of doing community work, and they have no desire to understand public policy. They just want to win and get in office and then have somebody dictate to them what should be done. And that's why they can't sit down and talk to guys like you, Mr. Coelho, you know, or you, Mr. Sweeney.
You know,
because it's not on their agenda. They don't understand. They don't understand. Hold on. They don't understand public policy and civic engagement. That's what it's called. Civic engagement. Understanding the needs of your community and then meeting them where they're at. And with that, I'll digress. You brothers keep getting down.
All right. Right. Good.
Thank
good.
You for that.
All right. Now, one thing is, and let me just insert this. If you're not talking, go on mute, please, because I'm getting background noise. Okay? Y'all guys can do that for me. All right. Now, let me go back to Jose.
Yeah, no, I thought that was great. Great political visioning in terms of what needs to happen. And again, I go back, I'm going to continue to use this word organized, because until we learn what organization means and how to do it, there's nothing that I've achieved that was not done by organizing. What I am happy about is the young brothers that came up under me in East Flatbush, the Christophers and the Vals and the gentlemen that grew up under me, they learned the majority of their leadership that they know now, not just from me, but from the learnings that I've had from the older folks. So this is a passed down relationship that we have to get back to. The elders are still here, and we need to sort of encapsulate and put, sometimes we got to put bubble wrap around some of our elders, because we want to make sure that we can still learn from them. And so I'm glad to see that some of the young brothers on this call sort of get the grift of how we have to move forward. I've got three of my sons are in construction. They wouldn't have got there if I hadn't pushed down some of these walls. My daughter's in politics on the administrative side. I have a younger brother that's now chief of staff for a Bronx assemblyman up in the Bronx. I don't take credit for that, but I love it because I recognize that they've been listening. And some of the things that I have said have worn off. And there's just a lot of people, not just within my family, but in a circle of families that have done well because they've learned how to organize and put these pieces together.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, hey, Jose, hold on. Jose, you're talking about my guy Leonardo, all right? Yeah, he and I know each other well. I'm actually a district leader here in the South Bronx, so I attend a lot of events. And I run into your brother. Actually, I had posted the flyer for this interview, I had tagged your brother in it, and he hit the like button, and I believe he shared it as well. So I know he's listening. Leonardo, what's up, my brother? I'm going to see you at the Bronx Dems holiday party on Tuesday, December 21st. Drinks on you, my man.
Hey, can I sneak in another quick question? A very important point.
Yes.
Is it all right? Okay. So, Joe, and ladies and gentlemen, we just had one of the largest congressional presidential bill put forth for as infrastructure. And already, I think last week or the week before, the Black Caucus and some others are already questioning the MWB participation. And with that being said, are we, you know, as you stated, organized? I was thinking state-to-state organization, because the money is going to flow throughout the entire country. Every state's going to get their piece. Every person going to get their piece. And the union is highly involved with that. Are we going to be like SCORE, the mentorship program that they had at the 26 Federal Plaza, where you can go and you can meet someone that is in that industry or in that field? Because we have a lot of supply chains that the black community, the African-American community has not tapped, like fish. We buy more fish probably than just about anybody, but we don't own a fish market. Certain supply chains that we were discussing, and I was talking to people, that it doesn't take a lot, but they're in our neighborhoods and they're sucking up the money. So with that being said, all of that funds coming down, we need to start, even if, you know, because I mentor a lot of companies and, you know, I don't care who it was. You look like me, I want to help you. And if you didn't look like me, we help you. And I think you know that from me. How are we going to hold them accountable? And that trickle down effect can't work when you're talking about a half a trillion dollars.
Right, right. I want to step back 1 second. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Now, go ahead.
I wanted to step back, Reg, to when you mentioned Stephanie Zinnemann, one of our brightest and great up-and-coming assembly person. I was down at Somos in Puerto Rico about 3 weeks ago, and we probably sat down the most, because she's still in a part of Brooklyn that I have family and that I have love for, which is downtown in the 57th and the 36th. Mm-hmm. And we sat for a long time looking at her vision for downtown Brooklyn. And so I know for a fact that anything that I'm going to be doing is going to be going through her. I can't go through anyone else that I believe does not understand political science, does not have political will. I'm going to sit there, because the exact thing you said about her, where she stepped back and said, I don't just want to sign this and be part of the gang. I got to see if my people in the street are going to understand why I did this. And I'm glad she went to you, because you and I share some of the same ideas. That's the type of vision we have to have. We can't go along to get along, because that has hurt us through the years. And so the whole idea of this infrastructure bill, we need some seminars and some sessions, mm-hmm. some layman sessions. All right. There's a lot of language that even flies over my head sometimes, and I get sleepy looking at it. But we got to break it down to layman's terms, where we can sit down and have contractors come into a room and say, okay, you do buildings. What do you do? You do the envelope for a building. You do roofing. You do painting. Do you have A? Do you have B? Do you have C? What's your track record? Have your taxes been cleared up? We need to get all that done first before they can even talk about getting an infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's going to be a lot of rules and regulations that are going to be put in to slow us down from getting that money. There's always rules and regulations that have been added when money is put on that table. And so that's where we have to organize. Let's organize and get our folks to understand they got to pull into this 21st century. And don't waste your time. If you can't get there, don't waste your time, your workers' time, your family time. Let's help you find some other entity to
find your niche. Yeah.
Let's find Chris. Your niche. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Chris.
I just wanted to chime in real quick, because I'm a product of a construction family. You know, my father was in Local 3. My two brothers were in Local 3. I think I was Reg's first employee. We used to be on the train.
Really?
With the paint.
Yeah.
Yes, with the paint buckets going uptown, painting
apartments.
So, and I was in Local 3 as an apprentice, and I left to go to the Department of Sanitation. My point is, all of this money is coming out, right, with this bill. But far too many of our kids don't know the trades, because we have been bamboozled into shifting our children all off to college. And many of them are not college students. They're not college ready. They need to learn trades. And we've been and part of the problem is that money is out there, but our kids can't do the trades. We have to start pushing these young men, who many of them are not going to go to college. And we have to be realistic about that. And we have to start teaching them these trades, because it's a lost art. You can't get people to do this work anymore. And that's another reason. More than anything, more than getting at the table, having companies, you got to have the people to do the work. And we got to start pushing people into that arena.
Well, I think that we've mentioned it several times, that college is not the avenue for everybody. You got people that's doing, you know, HVAC, I think that's what you call it.
HVAC.
These highly skilled trades. And that's their vocational school. They can make $150,000 to $200,000 a year. You know, I mean, that's another route. But you also have to have the college route, because you have to have the intellectuals. You have
I'm not saying that we don't have to have the college route.
You have to have both routes, both lanes.
Right. But we have been pushed to believe everybody needs to go to college, because college has become a hustle now. It's a business. It's $60,000 to send your kid to a school a year. That's outrageous. And yes, vocational schools.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
schools are out there, but I learned some of these trades in junior high school and high school. They used to teach this stuff for free.
Yeah, I understand.
He had a tough dad, Chris. You know, he was, my father, we were working when we were 13.
Listen, and he didn't give allowance. But I wanna give you had to go to work.
Yeah. Can't do that. But I want to give you guys some hope, because the beautiful thing that I just witnessed, Joe, and a couple of things. I'm doing project management, Joe, around the corner. I got two of them. And we got to learn Spanish, because I'm the only one that speaks English on the job. That's another story. But all in all, when I was talking at a few years back, maybe when we were really heavily going up to Albany, Joe, lobbying and doing all this craziness, when I said that we need a black union, I think they took it the wrong way. I was just saying, you could belong to any one of the unions that you're in the trade, but us as a race, we need to have our own lobby mechanism as a whole. And that's like you said, it's organizing. We needed to have some type of, you know, for the companies that wasn't union. I was a non-union shop until, you know, many strikes and all that. I was able, when you make that union route, you don't have the leverage like I did, where if a guy lived next door to me or the brother came home from prison, I could put him on, you know, my cousins, all of them, you know. But once you step towards the organized labor route, things change. And the goal is, if you still have a company that is out there that can train them, you got to be willing to do it. We got to do it for ourselves, because I never forget what this white gentleman told me. He said, "Hey, you, come here." He said, "You actually won that bid in there, but that ain't the one for you. What you're doing, you got these guys working. We were busting them up to purchase. We were doing everything. I was able to give them a shot, let them work a couple of, you know, 6-7 months. They get unemployment, do all that stuff. But we was training them, and we missed that. And we have to have a cohesive plan going forward, whether it be a white paper to the president, the white. You don't see them coming and doing debates in our neighborhood. We don't get a chance. You know, I got to go to Iowa one day, you know, to get a word in. We have to really, 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 as a race, as a community, understand, as we all know, construction is lucrative. We got to trade off these construction jobs for these guns. I think we can do it, because there's light at the end of the tunnel, because I do see a lot of young guys. You know, I'm in Flatbush. They're taking on their family business. They're getting involved. You know, they want to work. It's the political mechanism that we got to get them there. And we got to make sure that if, in fact, you are really serious about wanting to work, there's a lot of businesses that need help. Minority businesses, you know, family. I know an HVH guy. He don't have no kids. He has nobody. He wants to turn the company over to somebody, but he wants you to earn it. And it can be done. So there's hope, but we got to really, really set the tone going forward. The vote has a price to it. I don't care who you are, and we need
there
to
be a price attached to it.
Exactly.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
You know, that's
you're
absolutely what I meant. Yeah. Right. You know, it's Friday. I just want to wish all y'all happy holidays. Stay safe. Joe, it's great to hear. Joe, I didn't know you were that smart, brother.
I try to be. I got to go look up the word filibuster now. Thanks, Rick.
I do want to just break down the acronym OSHA, and I know what it means, but for some of the audience, what does OSHA stand for?
You want to help? Well, you go first, Joe.
I know what it is, but I'm going to tell me.
The occupation, wait a minute, I'm looking at it right now. Job Safety and Health is the, Joe, you help me, because I got the sign on the
occupation. You don't want me to define it. I know what it is.
Occupational Safety and Health Administration of the United States Department of Labor.
Yeah,
am I wrong, Joe?
No, you're absolutely right.
All right, I just wanted our listeners that at least, you know, we try to have, they got a lot today from y'all guys. All right, especially you, Joe, you were there the longest, and then Reggie came in and supplemented on a more granular level, and I appreciate that. But Joe, let me just thank you, you know, for being on the show. You know, I'll be following you, and y'all guys, follow the Walt Weekly podcast. Also, this will be rebroadcast on Sunday after 3 p.m. It'll be pushed out to all of the platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify. And I'm going into Michelle's territory because she usually does this part of the show. All right, but wherever you listen to your podcast, you will find the TWW interview for Antonio Cecilio Coelho. I'm sorry.
Yes, of
course. Okay, senior. I'm a senior too. I'm Walter Latham senior. So I shouldn't have dropped that senior there. Okay, so anyway, guys, I'm going to turn it over to Sierra because we're pushing the clock. It was a great show. And again, thank you. And y'all guys have a nice weekend. I'm going to turn it over to Michelle.
And you keep doing what you're doing, Mr. Whitney. And I thank my brother, my sister, and Joe. And I love y'all, man. You inspired me to start my own podcast. That's why I call myself Fat.
We appreciate
great.
That.
Great. We appreciate it. Definitely appreciate that.
Yeah. Right. Gene, real quick, do you have anything to say in closing? You or Chris, you guys are good.
I'll be in touch.
Yeah, I do.
Go ahead.
Yes. Yes, I do. Please keep doing what you're doing, brothers, and keep pushing the envelope when it comes to small business and teaching. Teaching these brothers, you know, not only the industry, but how they can get in there and make millions and more importantly, hire others. I'm not going to say his name, but there was a brother that used to roll with guys like you, Mr. Coelho, riding around to the construction sites, and he got on, and now he's a multimillionaire, and he has a fleet of like 10 to 12 cement trucks, and he's out there getting it, and he's hiring black and Latino, and I hope to have him on the show one day. And he's a very good friend of mine. So trust me, getting somebody an entry level in the construction field could yield dividends in the future for our people. And with that, my brother, God bless you.
Thank you.
Amazing. Right. Chris, real quick.
No, I was just going to say, Joe, I'll be in contact. We got a lot to talk about. We'll keep the lines of communication going. Thanks for coming on, brother.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you all. Thank you, Walter. And thank you to our guests, Jose Coelho, and our amazing panel members, Gene and Christopher and Reginald Sweeney, for coming in this week. Thank you so much. We appreciate our live audience for joining us for our weekly Friday Live. We hope you all enjoyed this live broadcast from New York City. Please join us next week as we celebrate the holidays. Christmas Eve, we will not have a show, but we will be celebrating next week's show and also talking about mental illness during the holidays. So follow us on IG at The Walt Weekly and Facebook at The Walt Weekly. Our website is www.thewaltweekly.com. You can find us on all streaming platforms, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio. Have an awesome weekend. Be safe and enjoy.
All right. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you. Hey, we got some big things coming up. So hit that follow button and notification button so that you can be notified. All right. We got some great shows coming up.
And thank you, Joe. Have a great weekend. The door's open for anybody else to come on this show, Joe. Bring them through.
That's right.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah. Let me thank Chris for bringing in Joe. Because this is very, very a learning experience, and that's what we try to get out there. We want people to learn. We want people to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
And don't invest in a black construction company, because when we hit it right, your dividends is more than putting your money in.
I want a prospectus on that. Whoever that was, I want a prospectus.
That was me, Reggie.
Okay, Reggie. I want a prospectus, man.
Thank you. Send me one. Appreciate having
All right.
Thank you, guys. Good night.
Great.
Good night.
Bye bye.
God bless.